As I said, we've got a lot of folks on vacation right now, some road trips happening with some folks in the church. It makes me think about road trips I took when I was a kid. We never flew anywhere. We always drove. Something I often did not like as a kid, but I appreciate it now. But one of the things that I liked about taking long road trips, it might have been to our great-grandparents' house in North Carolina. That was usually where we went. One of the things I really appreciated about the trips was often we would get snacks and treats and things that we weren't allowed to have the rest of the year. It was like there was sort of this kind of junk food license on road trips. One of those things was Pop-Tarts. I'm not going to argue for or against the nutritional value of Pop-Tarts, but it was just something we were not generally eating for breakfast, but we had them on car trips. And I remember one particular trip in which I experienced incredible, overwhelming disappointment because I was so excited as we started this trip. We probably weren't out of Perrysburg yet. That's where I grew up. Before I said, Mom, can I have the Pop-Tarts? And we left so early in the morning, we're all bleary-eyed, up way earlier than we normally would be, and I was fixed on these Pop-Tarts. And my mom said, sure, and she passed me back the box, and my heart sank because I pulled it out of the bag, and they were generic Pop-Tarts. Not just generic Pop-Tarts, because there are probably some brands that are good, and yet this was a brand called Staff brand from Food Town, which doesn't exist anymore. And I thought, most of the Staff brand stuff is gross. But they look like Pop-Tarts. They're strawberry, my favorite flavor. Let's try them. And I opened up that package, and they were gross. They were gross. Took one bite, put it back in the bag and tried to hide my disappointment. It was one of those things that seemed just as good, right? One strawberry Pop-Tart is as good as another because they look very similar. Probably had the same nutritional value. The box was the same size. And when you open it up, you thought, this doesn't smell quite the same, but it looks the same. And yet those suspicions of this being a kind of a cheap substitute were confirmed as soon as I bit into it. As soon as I thought, well, I'm hungry. This is designed for nourishment and enjoyment, so I'll bite into it to see. And it was through that attempt at nourishment and enjoyment that it was made plain, this is not the real thing. The off-brand Pop-Tarts did not provide me nearly the sense of nourishment, enjoyment, I could argue personal fulfillment that regular Pop-Tarts would have. They seemed just as good until I was actually hungry. It seemed fine, like a perfectly reasonable substitute until it mattered. There are all sorts of things that we rely on in our lives that seem reliable, that seem unshakable. It might be a relationship, whether a marriage or something else. It might be our health. Maybe we've just been consistently healthy for as long as we can remember. It might be a job that we've had forever and seems untouchable. It might be a growing retirement nest egg that we can look to and we get our monthly statement and breathe kind of a sigh of satisfaction that this thing is growing. And then something happens, something outside of our control that shatters that illusion that this thing is utterly reliable. that relationship that seemed so solid can go sideways. An accident or an unexpected illness can shatter this illusion that our health will remain indefinitely. We can suddenly get called into our boss's office out of the blue and have our boss say, "You know what, you've done great work here, but I'm sorry, the economy is just not what it was." And I know a lot of people about 10, 12 years ago who had these invincible 401ks that were decimated when the stock market crashed. Could they have prevented that? Could they have done something about that? No. It's in these events that we realize that these things that we think are the foundations of our life, the things that we rely on for security, for a sense of hopefulness to the future, these things are rattled and we get rattled. Because we think, if these are the things I'm relying on and I shouldn't be, where does that leave me? And so when we experience that kind of catastrophe, we deal with not just the situation itself, but we deal with the sense of disappointment, the sense of futility that comes along with it. So what do we do? Because it's one thing to say, "I don't believe in a God, I don't believe in Jesus, I don't believe in all that religious stuff." And by extension, the deepest thing you have to hope in is something like your own ingenuity, your own health, your own money. You can't go any deeper than that because you don't think there is anything deeper than that. But for the Christian person, we should say, "I shouldn't be rattled like this by these things. This kind of response shouldn't happen to me, but it does." And I think often it does because we don't apply the kind of attitude markers, the kind of truth that we should be and can be applying in these situations. Often when this kind of tragedy, this kind of unexpected circumstance happens in the life of a believer, we respond just like anybody else would because we don't cling to the truth that is ours to cling to. And I hope that as we look at our passage today, we'll be encouraged that when tragedy does come, and maybe you're experiencing the after effects of a tragedy right now, you'll be able to do so in a way that's fundamentally different because of the gospel than you would otherwise. Because we're going to look at Psalm 11 today, if you want to turn there with me. And what we're going to see in this psalm is that we can find encouragement in the midst of tragedy. We can find encouragement in the midst of difficulty when we cling to the God that we belong to rather than cheap earthly substitutes. As we've been going through the Psalms for the past couple months, we've seen that the believer is not excused from difficulty and hardship. We understand that the Christian life is not a life that is promised to be problem-free, hiccup-free. In fact, there are a lot of difficulties, complications to life that can come directly as a result of becoming a Christian person. And one of the great gifts within the Psalms is that they help us to understand how the godly person responds to hardship, how they respond to difficulty, injustice, these sorts of things. And we're going to see just such an encouragement here in this short psalm, Psalm 11. Allow me to read it. It says, "To the choir master of David, in the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, 'Flee like a bird to your mountain'? For behold, the wicked bend the bow. They have fitted their arrow to the string. to shoot in the dark at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of man. The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Let him rain coals on the wicked. Fire and sulfur and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his face. David writes this psalm in the midst of some kind of crisis. We don't know what it was. Some psalms have a kind of a historical annotation at the beginning of the psalm to tell us this psalm was written by David during this experience. We don't have that here. But we see that David was experiencing something in which the temptation or the natural reaction would have been to run, to freak out, to have the Chicken Little syndrome where we say, because this bad thing is happening, the sky is falling. And yet David responds differently. And so I hope that as we look at the psalm together, what we'll see is encouragement. Three specific things to remember when we're experiencing hardship in our life. And the first one is this. When we're experiencing hardship, some tragedy happens, some unexpected difficulty, let's remember who our foundation really is. I'm going to skip past the first part of verse 1. Because verse 1 is an answer to a question that we see in the next couple verses. Basically, David is experiencing a situation in which the natural response is, maybe this is people who were after him. You know, David, at several different points in his life, in his reign, was being chased after. The two most prominent ones being Saul. Saul was the first king of Israel, and he was not very good. He didn't seek after the Lord, and grew in arrogance. And so when he found out that David was going to be the next king, even though David was thoroughly respectful to Saul, he had no desire to take the throne even 1 minute earlier than God ordained for him. Saul had it out for him. He was consumed with jealousy and chased after David unjustly. David had to literally flee to the mountains. He had to hide. The second most prominent one was his son, David's own son, Absalom, who, through a variety of circumstances, was exiled, was able to return, and yet had incredible resentment towards his father, and stirred up a rebellion in which he took over the throne, and David again had to flee. So this might have been during one of those situations, or this might be figurative. This might be some other difficult situation that David was facing, where again, the natural response was to freak out. Because what's here in the second part of verse 1 through verse 3 is the natural response. Flee like a bird. The wicked have bent the bow. Bad things are happening. Bad people are out to get me. They're going to shoot me. I'm going to be destroyed by this. And it culminates in this question that's asked at the end of verse 3. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? That question gets right to the heart of the matter. Because the line of thinking goes something like, if the most unshakable things in my life are shaken, then what am I going to do with that? How can, if the things that I've ultimately relied on are destroyed, then I have nothing. I'm lost. I have no recourse but to panic. There are so many things in our life that we rely on assuming that they are invincible. As Americans, we like to spend our money on the assumption that we will never lose our job or take a pay decrease. In fact, we spend our money as Americans so arrogantly as to assume that our income is on this upward trajectory, and so we take on debt that we can't really afford right now, but on the assumption that our income's only going to go up and up continuously. So we're a country that is mired in incredible debt. Alcoholism is a growing epidemic in this country because we have young people in college who are so certain of their own physiological invincibility that they drink themselves unconscious consistently week after week. We live in a country consumed by entertainment because we have so much leisure time that we consume entertainment and we chase after the latest recreational whatever as if that's the ultimate apex of human experience. And it's one thing for me to say all these people around me are chasing after these false things, and yet I could point to a number of instances even in the past week in which I made a decision that would reflect something as the foundation in my life other than Christ himself. And so these situations come our way where we say, this thing that I thought was unshakable has been shaken. My money, my health, my relationships. And David says, the natural thing to do is, because that thing is shaken, to freak out. And yet he says in verse 1, in the Lord I take refuge. So how can I say to my soul, freak out about this? Why would I say, you better freak out about this, if I'm taking refuge in the Lord, in Yahweh? As we've talked about before, when you see the word Lord in the Old Testament with a big capital L and then a little uppercase O-R-D, it's not a translation of the Hebrew word for Lord, which is Adonai. It's a Hebrew. It's a translation of the Hebrew name, Yahweh. The name of God. The name that God revealed to his covenant people. And so when David calls on Yahweh, he's not calling on some distant, impersonal God that's somewhere out there in the cosmos. He's calling on the God who has made a covenant with him. He's appealing to the personal God. The personal God who has promised to keep and protect and safeguard David. And so he says, if this is my foundation, if the Lord, Yahweh, my covenant father, is my foundation, then why would I freak out when these other things are shaken? That doesn't make any sense. It would make sense if I didn't know this covenant father. That would make sense. If I'm betting everything in my life on the stability of my finances and my finances fall apart, then yeah, it would make total sense to freak out. But that's not what my foundation is. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? And David's response is, that would be a valid question if Yahweh wasn't my foundation. Because he is, my foundation is not destroyed. In Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 to 27, Jesus says this, "Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell. And great was the fall of it." One thing that's fascinating to me about this little parable that Jesus tells is the fact that the same exact things happened to both houses. He uses the exact same words, the exact same terms to describe what happened to each house. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and beat against that house. And yet what happened to both of those houses was totally opposite, not because of the nature of what happened. It wasn't because the one who built his life on Christ had an easy time of it. It wasn't because simply no storms came to that house. The same storms came, and yet it was okay because it wasn't built on the foundations of money and reputation and these other kinds of things, but built on Christ himself. So when difficulty comes, when crisis arises in our lives, let's remember who our foundation really is. Secondly, let's remember that our suffering has a purpose. It has a purpose. The first part of verse 4, the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. This is an indication of God's sovereignty, the fact that he is high and elevated above these things that are happening. David is expressing his confidence in the Lord, one, because he knows that God is not in the middle of this, that these events, these tragedies, these hardships that happen to him are not taking God by surprise, as if God was in this same sort of chronological timeline with this limited vision that David has. He knows that God is above all this. He's in charge over all of this. So these things do not take God by surprise the way they take him by surprise. And not only this, it's not just that he can see these things. It's not just that he's outside of these things. But David sees a purpose in his suffering. Because he says not just his eyes see what happens, but his eyelids test the children of man. The Lord tests the righteous. It's not just that God sees what happens to us. It's not just that God permits things to happen to us. But God uses actively trials and difficulty in our life to test and refine us, to shape us. We grow in holiness so much more effectively in hardship than we do in easy times. Hardship is a part of his plan to grow us in godliness and grow us in intimacy with himself. There is a purpose in our suffering. In Hebrews 12, verses 7 to 11, we read something incredible. The writer of Hebrews says, "It is for discipline that you have to endure." Wow. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which we've all participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we've had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. But later, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Writer says, I'm not going to pretend that these difficulties, these hardships we face, are pleasant. They are not pleasant. There are times when my kids want to do something else. They want to go play outside. They want to play video games. I say, not before you clean your room or you empty the dishwasher or something like this. And they just, oh, Dad, it's not what I want. When we have kids over that we're babysitting, I don't make them do stuff like that. When we have kids over, we're watching somebody's kids for a while, we just let them have fun. They play with our kids. They play laser tag in the backyard. They play video games. I don't make them clean the room. I don't make them clean the bathroom. I don't make them unload the dishwasher because they're not my kids. Because of my responsibility and my love for my children, I put them through situations that they don't like, that they would prefer to avoid. For the moment, all discipline, hardship seems painful rather than pleasant. But later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. One thing that can really be salt in the wound when we're experiencing a hard time is wondering if this suffering is meaningless. Wondering if we're just experiencing the futility of the world. And I can say, as Christian people, we are not. There is nothing hard that happens to us that God says, wow, I didn't see that coming. I've got to figure out something quick. There is meaning. There is purpose in our suffering. That's not a Hallmark sentiment. I know that one of the worst things you can do with someone who has just experienced some kind of hardship or tragedy or loss is to give them platitudes like God has a purpose and all this sort of thing. It might be true, but it's just an insensitive thing to say at the time. But we don't have to compound our suffering by wondering if our tragedy is a sign that God doesn't care or if he's not in charge or something like this. He is in charge. He does care. And our suffering has a purpose. Finally, just as we should remember who our foundation really is, that our suffering has a purpose, let's remember our ultimate prize, which is God himself. In verse 4, in the beginning part of verse 5, we see it zeroing in on the righteous. God tests the righteous. He refines them. And then the second part of verse 5, we see quite the contrast. But his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Let him rain coals on the wicked. Fire and sulfur and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. Wow. It's very vivid. One of the things that David is appealing to here is God's justice. The fact that he can trust the God who has covenanted with him, not just because of his sovereignty, not just because his suffering has a purpose, but also understanding that God is just. God does not just let wrongdoing go unchecked forever. We've talked about this several times. This is an ongoing theme as a part of David's exhortations to us and to himself in the midst of these psalms is reminding himself and us that God is just and that he will set all things right. Evil will be punished. Evil does have an expiration date, after which it will never happen again because he will bring a final conclusive judgment. Ultimately, those who do not trust Christ will face eternal condemnation in hell. As we talked about last week in Psalm 10, even for those who seem to have it all together, where it seems like they never encounter any hardship in this life, if they don't have Christ, in the next life they will have nothing. Then the beginning of verse 7, for the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. Without Christ, I could read a verse like this and just shrivel up in shame and fear. Because I think if God is going to punish those who live sinful, selfish lives, but he loves the person who does the right stuff all the time, then I'm toast. Because that's not me. It would be easy for me to whitewash my evaluation of myself and say, yeah, I'm pretty righteous. I'm not. I'm not. And yet, by God's grace, we get to read the Psalms from a New Testament point of view. Understanding, as we've talked about numerous times over the past couple months, that the Psalms have their immediate historical context, and yet they are messianic music, as one commentator calls them. When we read the Psalms together, we see this incredible mosaic of one who is like David and yet not David. We see one who is a king, who would simultaneously be a prophet, who would simultaneously suffer on behalf of his people, and unlike David, reign forever, unchallenged. And we know that this is Jesus, the king who would apply his perfect righteousness to us. So that when we see these exhortations to unfailing righteousness in the Psalms, we can, rather than shrink back in shame, say, Father, thank you that because I'm united with Christ through the gospel, that's me. You see me this way. That because Christ's death paid for my sin, and his resurrection purchased new life for me, and that by calling on him in faith and repentance, I'm united with him, this picture of the righteous man, I can say, thank you that I'm united with Christ, the one who exemplifies this. And so I have nothing to fear. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. And then in the last part of verse 7, we see the culmination of this psalm. The upright shall behold his face. Just as unbelievers will ultimately lose everything that they have gained in this life and face punishment in the next. For the Christian, it's the opposite. No matter how hard things may be now, no matter how difficult things may be now, all of our hardship will be wiped away and we will enjoy our ultimate reward, which is God's presence forever. Because God is the ultimate, unfailing source of true joy, the most loving thing he could possibly give us was the means by which we might be able to know and enjoy him and experience him in that way. And so it makes no sense for us to live as Christian people like this world is all that there is. Like short-term happiness is the best that we can hope for. It's not. I don't say this lightly. I don't say this to cheapen what any of you may have experienced or are currently experiencing, whether with your health, with your finances, with your relationships. It might be something internal. It might be a struggle that is not even necessarily connected to the circumstances around you. It might be depression or something like this. As we endure these things, let's remember who our foundation really is. It is Christ himself. It's not the things of this world that may seem unshakable and yet we know are not. Let's remember that our suffering has a purpose. We are God's children, and he leverages difficulty in our life in order to shape us and grow us. And let's remember our ultimate prize, that this life is not all that there is, that we have an eternal hope. It's not a cop-out in the midst of difficulty to say, but I have heaven waiting for me. That's not a cop-out. When I'm going on a fun trip in an airplane and there's turbulence in an airplane, I hate that. It makes me feel nervous and nauseous. But I don't freak out, because I know it's going to be over. And I know that the turbulence is just something that happens on the way to this destination. We can find encouragement in crisis by relying on the God that we belong to, who is our foundation, who uses our suffering for his purposes, and whose presence we'll be able to enjoy one day forever. Let's pray together.